This interview is with Mr. Kevin Cleary, and it's taking place at his home on the 8th of July 2002. The interviewer is John Reed. Kevin, thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed.
Thank you for coming.
Our subject is the recent history of St. Mary's, and we're following on, in a sense, from the interview you did some years ago with Angela Baker. And so I'd like in a moment to perhaps ask you some things about your role as registrar and your later administrative roles and surrounding issues. But you've just been telling me about the era of the Diefenbaker government and the era when John Diefenbaker came to St. Mary's to receive an honorary degree, and a conversation I believe you had with Edmund Morris about that. So could you just start us off with that story?
It's a little later note to begin on, I guess. Yes, we had, the university had decided to give John Diefenbaker an honorary degree, and he'd be, I guess, the first conservative prime minister for some time at that point in the Canadian history. And I was an active member of the local Liberal Club at that time, and as Liberals were at that time, we were quite incensed at being defeated, of course. The president of the Liberal Association at the university was Gordon MacLean, and he was downtown, and Edmund Morris and Robert McLeod were coming to speak to the students, and excuse me, they were going to speak to us in room 203, which was one of our bigger classrooms at that time.
They being the two MPs.
They being the two MPs. At that time, Halifax had a split. It was a two-seat house in the house, two seats. Anyway, Edmund was, and still is, I guess, known to be hot under the collar at times when he was challenged. And I proceeded to challenge him on behalf of the Liberal Party and the government. And they had a few scandals early on at the time, and we were kind of picking on that. And he proceeded at one point to try to embarrass me, maybe, I don't know, by saying that the university had seen fit, our esteemed institution had seen fit to give the Right Honorable John Diefenbaker an honorary degree. And my response was that, you know, nobody should hold the students responsible for what the esteemed university decides to do. Whereupon I was advised I was a kind of, maybe, something equivalent to a snotty-nosed young student with a lot to learn. And Robert McLeod, who was the cooler of the two, I guess, kind of eventually ushered Edmund out. And I guess I was a kind of cause celeb for a day or two, having taken on Member of Parliament and not done too badly on it. Of course, Edmund and myself have become such very good friends since then.
Hi.
So we were still on the interview with Edmund Morris.
Of course, Edmund and myself have become sincere and very good friends since that time. He's still a very gracious person, always was then, I guess, but as I say, I was a young, I was a wet behind the ears young student who, maybe not as young as everybody thought I was at that time. I already had my arts degree and was doing education.
So at that time you were an education student, but not too much later than that you became registrar at St. Mary's. And could you describe for us just how that came about?
Well, it came about, I had been, when I finished my education degree, actually, the registrar's job was open, and the Father Fisher, who was then, I guess he was Dean of Studies, so he may have been president at that time. He became president. Let it be known that if I really wanted the job as registrar, that I could have it. And I thought about it and thought about it, but I had wanted to teach, and I had a teaching opportunity in Newfoundland, and I decided no, I would take up my teaching opportunity. And I taught high school in Grand Falls for 2 years, and then came back to do a master's degree. And I was the first full-time master's student at the University of Richmond. The master's program was basically part-time, all my confreres in the program are part-time, and I remember Father, it'll come back in a second, Father Dan Fogarty, who was the dean, trying to convince me to do it part-time and teach, but I had saved some money. I was an indentured servant from the Newfoundland government. I had borrowed money from them to come back to do this. And that's what I was classed as, an indentured servant. Eventually had to repay the money when I decided not to go back to Newfoundland. Finished the degree, and in the spring of doing the degree, the word trickled down again that if I really wanted to go on staff, they would be happy to have me. So that was in 60, 61, I was doing my degree. So in the spring of 61, when I finished my master's degree, I joined the university as assistant to the Dean of Studies, who was Father Stewart at that time. Because by that time, Mrs. Judd had come on staff and was registrar and doing an excellent job. And so as assistant to the Dean of Studies under Father Stewart, I was responsible for freshman arts and science students, because there was the Dean of Studies was in effect Dean of Arts and Science. He was a dean, so there were no deans, individual deans at that time. There was a Dean of Engineering, who was Jim Ryan, the Dean of Commerce, and Father Stewart was Dean of Studies, who was also Dean of Arts. So I served that capacity for 2 years, and then in 1963 I became registrar, with Father Stewart as the Dean of Studies. And Father Shields came in and took over as assistant to the Dean of Studies. But as assistant to the Dean of Studies, I was responsible for, as I say, arts and science freshman students, and also for evening division, as it was called. Before that, evening division had been run by Father Rourke. He had been just he had taught sociology. He was the one who developed the sociology program at the university, out of which has grown, of course, our criminology program. And the evening division, and then there was a program at school down there called continuing education, which was non-credit. And evening division students weren't permitted generally to take courses that were offered before 4:30 in the afternoon. And also evening division students at that time had to finish the equivalent, to get the degree, had to finish the equivalent of a full-time year on campus, degree 5. I don't know how much that was honored. I don't remember how much that was honored in the breach of that arrangement. Because they were all teachers, and a lot of Navy personnel. Because the Navy, unlike the Army, most of the officer corps in the Army were graduates of universities, whereas the Navy personnel really weren't much. So we had a lot of even division students were Navy people who were finishing off degrees and teachers.
Would that include women teachers?
Oh yes, an awful lot of women teachers. Even division, I think, was predominantly women students at that time. And I remember when I was doing my arts degree, when you usually got when you had a 4:30 class, which you tried to avoid at all costs, but you had to have them, they were usually populated with probably by teachers in the late 50s when I was a student.
So most of these people would be from a variety of ages.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. They would all have been older than we were as undergraduates. Some of them seemed to us to be ancient, but they really weren't, of course, because they were that. But they would have been in their early 20s, because they all would have gone through normal school and had been teaching a few years.
Tell me about the continuing education courses, the non-credit ones. What kind of people would take those?
They were generally people in the community. They had courses like armchair philosophy and things like that, and great books, courses like that, and kind of they would be 4 and 5 week lectures type of thing. And I just know that Father Belair ran that operation. think the late Charlie Maguire, when he came on staff, I think he ran some of the two things, kind of director of public relations, but he worked with Father Jack Belair. So they were all people who were in the community, who were business people, who were looking for a kind of intellectual outlet. And he taught, there were things like courses in speed reading taught. Matter of fact, that's how I met my first wife, Elizabeth. Betty McClain, she had taken this feeling of course and was teaching it on behalf of our father. And I was involved in drama, as I was all the time. And I remember one night coming up from the stage and seeing this rather good-looking young woman, and decided I'd like to meet her, which I did eventually. And she was teaching this feeling of course for Father Jack Blair.
Now, would some of the courses be taught by regular faculty?
I don't. Yes, they were, but they were. I remember Father Lynch teaching what was called armchair philosophy. He was president at the time, so they were kind of laid back, you know, type of things. But the reading division was the educational component of the institution.
In your role as assistant to the Dean of Studies, now you would presumably advise students, that would be part of your duty. What other things would you do in that role?
Well, I also was responsible for developing the scheduling classes, and I remember developing quite a long program that would enable somebody who began their evening division studies this particular year to map the whole program out. It was a pretty standardized program. You did X number of courses in history and philosophy. I did that type of thing, and we did the counseling of students. It was around that time too that we really, I guess, began recruiting students. At that time, St. Mary's at that time, there was a non-written rule that you didn't impinge on St. Evex territory because of the archdiocese. And I think the cutoff thing was around Truro somewhere, where you didn't go beyond that direction to recruit students. But when I was a student, there were a group of us who felt the same, because we were in residence and we were all from rural areas, of course. And we used to borrow the university car and go to some of the places where the kids came from, like Muscadot and places like that, to visit schools, to tell, you know, so even as a student we were involved in that, but there was no organized recruiting that program. Then when I became assistant to the Dean of Studies, Bob Hayes and myself would do it, and we'd take Father O'Donnell along sometimes, and we'd go down to Chester and places like that, and through contacts get into a school. There was no real program, but that's how the genesis of the recruiting program began.
Was there any religious dimension to this, or would you particularly see Catholic people as contacts, or would there be any kind of conscious desire to recruit Catholic students?
Well, be more contact because you know somebody. I remember the difficult time I had to get into Queen Elizabeth High School. I was registrar at that time, and we could never get invited there. It was the strangest thing. So one summer I had worked, or one winter I had worked with Len Hannon, who was then principal, that's what you think. And I forget the Dean of Arts and Science name at Dalhousie. He was the Dean of Arts and Science. But we had a committee, because at that time there was a thing called the CAC, the Central Advisory Committee on Education, and was trying to do some standardization of things. So there was a committee set up to try and get a standardized application form for high schools to make it easier for them to apply. And I remember I worked on this committee with Len Hann and myself, and I think the father, I forget his name's name, but he was the Dean of Arts and Science, and the Dean of Arts and Science at Dow, I think he was one of the forces for one program. And we had worked several times during the winter or one thing or another, and we came up with a uniform application form. And I remember then sitting down one day at coffee with Len Hann and saying, well, now, Len, you've known me long enough to know I don't have horns sticking out of me. When are you going to let me come and speak to your students? Those interested students who may want to go to seminaries. Well, what else could he do but say, okay, we'll set it up. Well, it took us a little bit of setting up. And I remember arriving at his school and being greeted with him by him and saying, now don't judge all our students by this group you're going to meet. So it was quite obvious I wasn't getting anywhere near the cream of the crop. But I remember, I won't mention the name of the student, but I remember three or four that I recruited out of that group who, they were, you know, I went into the class and they were like all high school classes, they were segregated in a sense. And I cottoned onto these two pretty quickly because I had been teaching. So I was familiar with the nuances of it. And one of them became quite a lawyer for individual rights afterwards. The other three became quite good teachers in the school system. So, but it was interesting. That's how I broke in there. I remember going down to Muscadabit, having had a long, tired trouble to get into Muscadabit and high school, and getting in there and taking a student with me. And Dr. Vorstens, who taught at St. Mary's at that time, took his son, I think his name was Luke, with me as a student, and was making quite a good impression until Luke decided to, to treat the business of ecumenism in his own fashion. And he got up and turned to speak. He said, now I want all you students to understand that religion doesn't matter at St. Mary's. You know, we have the name St. Mary, but we don't do any of this religion bit there, one thing or another. And of course, people may not have wanted to hear proselytization, but they certainly didn't want to hear there was no religion at St. Mary's. So I took a devote. You could sense the temperature going down. It was a stormy winter day, and you could sense the temperature going down among the teachers who were sat in the classroom while they were doing this. A couple of interesting things like that.
Would you go to Acadian areas and recruit there?
By that time, the as registrar, of course, I was director of admissions and all of that stuff, so that there wasn't any. It was when we got our first director of admissions, I guess, which was Laurie Smith, and then Ken Mendelaer, and they're the ones who developed the recruiting program, and they did it in a much more systematic fashion. And they had, Ken had been with social services, and they developed a great deal of contacts throughout the whole system. So then they were going to King's Rural Iowa, these schools that were being built. And I, from that point on, I would go when I was asked by them to go and fill in or something. But as to the organization, I don't really know how it worked out.
I'm intrigued by what you mentioned a minute ago about the kind of informal geographical division with St. Evagnes. Were there any variations according to ethnicity? I mean, if there were Irish students in the St. Evagnes area or Scottish students in...
Purely geographical. I think the line was there. And I suspect it corresponded with the archdiocesan line.
Could I just get onto a slightly different topic that you mentioned a minute ago, and that's the question of the relationship with Dalhousie, because clearly in your career at St. Mary's that relationship changed a great deal, although perhaps in some respects, it may not have changed, I don't know. But well, could you just reflect generally on that
relationship? At the administrative level, was always very good between South and Dalhousie. Beecher Smith with the registrar, had been for years, and was a very gracious lady. And she had no time for this, you know, sense of feeling a superiority from me. So that there was never any question. We always had a great relationship that way, working relationship. What the political level was further up, I just, you know, and there was certainly at the one gathered at the professorial level a tendency to look down their noses at anybody, not just Samaritans, but anybody other than Dalhousie. And they had a, at least that was the feeling we got from the administrative level, no. And I think when Henry Hicks he was Dean of Arts and Science first and everything, president. Very affable man, never any question, always prepared to greet you as meet you on a par, and the courses on a par. Interesting thing that might be of some interest is that universities had sat down again with the Central Advisory Committee on Education. It was the Newfoundland was involved in that too, actually. Just off as an aside, the Newfoundlanders were all orators. Whenever they were at a meeting, somebody always had to give a speech or something. They always had a... I think Cyril would have really shied at this. But one year we decided that we would make senior matriculation as the sole entry level. And it was decided. And St. Mary's and Dalhousie and Acadia, St. of X, that was the thing. And at St. Mary's actually, and Dalhousie stayed with it actually, but St. Mary's actually, we had notified everybody. And we came to a follow-up meeting at Dalhousie to finish this up. And the representative from Acadia came in and they had changed their mind. And I remember this person, I think he may have been the Dean of Arts, but I'm not sure, coming in and saying to the meeting that the people who had agreed to this did not have the authority to do it, and there was no way Acadia was going to do this type of thing. And they were staying with the two-level entries, the matric and junior. And I remember Father Fisher was then Dean or President. I remember how, and Laurie Smith was Director of Admissions, how terribly disappointed everybody was, because we had to come back, because we had to then revamp them and send out letters saying, look, we were only kidding, you know, in effect, we will take students from, but it would have been a giant step forward. And that was led by Dalhousie, and the Central Advisory Committee, you know, Scotia Universities are all behind it, but it was Acadia who got their backs up on the end, came back and said, no way, you're telling us what to do. Yeah. So it was one of these things. So at the administrative level, I think things get along very well. Now, at the political provincial level, or political presidential level, I suspect it might have been a little, because people get protecting their turf.
Would that, now you say at a political level, this is in terms of looking for provincial funds and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And carving out territories. I remember when the school for, and I used to have that file. I don't know what became, but I used to check the archives. I had a file on the development of the Maritime School of Social Work. Because that used to be a joint program between St. Mary's, King's, and Mount St. Vincent, and Dalhousie developed the School of Social Work. That had been tried some time before, back in when I was a student. And I remember that the Archbishop then was Archbishop Barry. Remember the statement had been made, and I'm sure it was made. I'm sure it wasn't something on my figment of my imagination, because I was pretty close to the Jesuit fathers and some of them didn't have driver's license, so occasionally I would drive them places, you know. And I remember Father Malone saying to me, who was Dean of Arts and Dean of Studies at that time, I remember driving him somewhere, and he was saying that they were thinking, Dalhousie was thinking of starting a school of social work. And Archbishop Barry was reported to have said that the minute Dalhousie opens an art school of social work, there'll be a school, Catholic school of social work down on English Street. And that stopped that. That would have been in the late 50s. So we continued on with the master's degree as a joint program between ourselves, the Mount at King's College. And so when I received my master's degree, there was Caroline McNeil, who received her master's degree in social work from St. Mary's. But she didn't take any courses. Well, she might have taken some courses, but I don't know how that worked at that time for the degree.
How and when did that change?
I forget the date now, if I could go downstairs, if I could go through my files, I have a file. I really intend that these were files I took with me because they were. I'm sure a lot of people had them, but there was a whole study done. And I would hesitate there.
What about the creation of the Atlantic School of Theology? That also must have made some waves among all the universities in the region.
Wasn't that impact in St. Mary's, because the biggest impact, I think, had been because it was Pine Hill Divinity was connected with King's, I think, wasn't it?
It was united.
I think the Catholic students were trained at the Forty Heart Seminary or some other place, so there was never any impact on our firm that I was aware of. There may have been something, but by the time that came along, that was. I guess we were a public institution by that time. So.
How much of a transition was it for yourself with your student background at the institution? Now, when you became, first of all, assistant to the Dean of Studies and then registrar, now, in a certain sense, the Jesuit fathers were your colleagues, perhaps you were a junior colleague at the time, but how much of a transition was that?
It wasn't that big because the thing I found most difficult at being registrar was trying to get professors to do things for me. I was still their student in many cases. But the Jesuit, the school had been small, and the relationship between the Jesuits and the individual students was always very close for me, so that you were always part of the thing. And you kind of came through the system that way. It was interesting, you know. The president always met with the senior class before graduation sometime to have a round table discussion of what we saw, we could make the place better, what type of thing. So that kind of collegiality was there from day one with the Jesuits. So there was always that interplay back and forth. The biggest thing personally to me was to get faculty to take me seriously, in the sense that, I think that's where my ulcers started developing, trying to get to meet deadlines. Or, you would be home and you'd get a call from somebody at 10 o'clock at night and say, look, I can't prep anymore, I'm dead tired, can I get these in 3 days from now?
That's the fate of every registrar, to try to
establish your authority on these things. But they were always very cooperative too, and there was a general degree of cooperation. And I suspect that was true of all smaller universities at that time, that, that people weren't, you know, you taught what had to be taught, whether that was really your field or, you know, you try and develop something to get your field in. But there was the Ratio Studiorum was there, you did your four courses in philosophy and four courses in this. And that slowly changed, slowly changed. I remember the very intense debate in Senate when we decided to do away with religion as compulsory courses. And I remember Dr. Bill Dalton, who had been one of my professors and very ardent lay Catholic man with a big family and very committed to one thing or another. I remember him being quite annoyed at me that I voted in favor of dropping religion as a compulsory course in the curriculum. I also remember, and I was on the other side of this battle, of when they decided to do away with the requirement for shirts and ties. And that was in it. And these were all Jesuit initiatives. They were all very far thinking. I remember coming out one day and Father Fisher, the Archbishop Barry was unwell, he had some brain tumors and one thing or another. He was incapacitated, so I think Bishop Hayes had just been appointed as Choco Adjutant. Monsignor Smith, who was the grand old man of the old school, was the chancellor. And I remember meeting Father Fisher one day. Monsignor Smith came out of his office, to my office, we were all bumped together. And I said to Father Fisher, the Monsignor doesn't look well. Is he on well? He said, I just told him, Kevin, he said that within 5 to 10 years you will be a layman's president of St. Mary's. He said, I think I may have brought on a stroke, I'm not sure. But they were trying to arrange a transfer of powers gently at that time, because they knew they weren't going to take the staff place. So they were always forward thinking.
When you described the Jesuits and their collegiality and the way that extended to students, the senior class being asked for their opinions, did that have an impact during the 1960s in terms of, my impression is that the student protests of that decade did not involve St. Mary's as much as some other institutions. Was that a factor? Or am I right, perhaps?
No, I think maybe you're not quite correct in that, because I think St. Mary's locally were the ones who led the charge on revolts and one thing. And I think that came from that kind of freewheeling. And unfortunately, these things came about when Father Lavelle had taken over as president. And he was an unwell man. He had had a tremendous car accident one summer up in the working in the, because he used to go up and work in the Indian missions. And he really was an unwell man. He was recuperating, and then they made him president. And we spent a lot of time, the group of us, this sounds very egotistical, it's not meant that way, but trying to corral him sometimes. He'd have these flights of real genius, but then when it came to implementing them, you know, you'd be out in left field somewhere and say, well, you can't do that stuff, you know. And at the same time then, he began to develop what I always refer to as the Feuerbunker mentality. He got in and when he could no longer deal with these students whom he created, and had pardon me, so that you had this, you know, plus you had some people who came on who hadn't moved at the Times either, you know, And so you had a bit of conflict between the students and the city. But for the most part, they were always pretty convivial and one thing like that.
What were the issues, the specific issues at the time?
Well, they sound pretty mundane now compared to what some of them were, but some of them were choice of classes, right to pick your own courses, residence rules were the big thing, relaxing the rules in residence. And we had just built a new big high rise, and nobody really knew how to deal with all these students we had. You know, that type of thing. Then they were brought in from outside because of the activists from outside. I remember one person in particular, Michael Sullivan, who was nicknamed by the faculty, by not the faculty, the administration. The faculty generally were people who were like Arthur Monaghan, who were trying to deal with this in a modern way. And you had the administration who was digging its heels into the old way. And Mike was nicknamed the Red Baron because he had a red beard. I remember most about him was the year before, he was from Ontario and he had been in the COTC. Clean cut. And I had taken recruiting with him as a prime example, you know. And the next September he came back a flaming revolutionary with his red beard and you know, and I couldn't believe it. So we always had a good open rapport. We would discuss, at that time I spent a lot of time in the corridors with these people arguing with them, and I would go out and take them on verbally. We always got along very well. I was referred to as the rude registrar, but they weren't flaming violent people. He then went off. I think he then went down to Cuba for one part of the time on the sugar cane. You know, later went off and did a PhD at the University of Saskatchewan. It's interesting that across Canada, a lot of these revolutionaries, in quotation, became the steadfast civil servants in the various provincial governments. It's interesting how they evolved.
Tell me more about these conversations you had with the students.
Well, I remember one particular one, the Mike and Simon Rosen. Simon was from Sydney. And Simon was, he might have been vice president. Anyway, I got a call from Father Tate. God love Father Tate, I don't know if you remember him, he was vice president. And a big man. And what I always referred to him as senior, I'd seen a revolution behind every bush. He didn't quite know how to deal with things. So he phoned me up one day and said, get everybody out of the registrar's office and lock it up. And I said, why? He said, they're coming down to take all the registrar's office. I said, who's coming down? He said, well, the Red Baron is coming down. And I said, fine. So I went out and stood in the corner, and the office is where it is now. So I watched these dozen or so people come down. So I met them out, and he said, what's going on? Now, Mr. Carey, we're going to take over your office. Very polite, you know. And I said, no, nobody's taking over my office. Right? So we discussed it for a while, and I said, okay, let's make a bargain, you and me. You and I'll get everybody to the office, and you and I'll go in. If I come out, the office is mine. If you come out, the office is yours. Well, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, you don't think you're going to take over my office without some kind of an argument, or maybe a fight? He said, a fight? I said, you know, a physical fight. I said, I'm not going to take that kind of crap off you fellows, you know. And he said, well, we don't want violence, he said. And I said, well, Mike, you got to realize, if you're going to have a revolution, you have to have violence. Oh, he said, yeah. Oh, he said, well, we better take somebody else's office over. So they walked out now. But they were the kind they were, you know. And I remember them, you know, being roundly reprimanded from Father Tate that, you know, I should have done the precautionary thing and nothing good because they could have wrecked the records. And I said, Father, you don't understand these people. They're not that type. They were our students for 2 or 3 years. Most of them were good Nova Scotians. They haven't invested in wrecking things. I could have been deadly wrong, you know. But that time was right, fortunately. But the protests were pretty at a pretty civil level. They did things pretty civil. I think a lot of that was due to the action of people like Ralph Monahan and these who were also able to deal with these students and talk to them. The Senate meetings were horrendous at that time. We used to have them at night. And they would start at 7 o'clock. Sometimes they'd go to 10 or 12.
Were Senate meetings open?
They were open then. The students would come in, and that particular group of students were pretty rude. They come in, they stick their feet up on the table, and they walk across the tables, because we would move out of the Senate room, which at that time was upstairs and now part of the psychology room, and we'd move over to a big room in the science building so that you could have it open, so that the people would walk around and that type of thing. They were kind of horrendous. That was a little more abrasive, I guess, at that time.
Well, was that before the era of student senators? Were there student senators?
I don't know. I think they were in the process of getting representation in the Senate. Because I think the student senators came on. That's all in the minutes there somewhere. But they came on when we had developed what is still the Senate room. And at that time, that was around that time, so that would have been part of the evolution of the thing. And I remember dear Dr. Dalton saying, give them representation because they're never going to come anyway. Which turned out to be pretty true. Remember him, okay. For heaven's sake, just give them representation. We'll set up some kind of procedure so we know what they're doing. I think even procedures are done by the board. They were supposed to be approved by Senate, but I don't think they ever heard of them. They elect them any way they see fit.
You mentioned that another issue at that time was the question of residence rules and disciplinary rules and so on. Now that must have... that kind of debate must have been shaped in part by the admission of women as full-time students in 1968.
That's right,
Could you recall?
Well, the interesting thing about the admission of students, we had been debating that, and the Archdiocese had set up a committee, and they were trying to, the bigger thing where you're trying to get the Mount and St. Mary's together. So there were all kinds of political things, undertones. Anyway, the Archdiocese, in his wisdom, or the committee, or the decided, kept this hanging fire till after registration, before we got permission to admit students. And because they were mainly worried about the effect on the Mount enrollment. And I remember I set up a special registration a week after, or 2 weeks after we had finished registration. And I think there was something like 25 women who left the Mount and came down to meet some parents. And it was a special registration. And I don't think the bishop was all that happy with me at that time, because, I'm sure, and I'm a great conspiracy theorist first, I'm sure the decision was made to keep the decision out till it was palatable, namely after registration was over, to save another year. And these people came, and then, of course, once that came, you had you had to provide some residence space for them. So then you had trying to block off rooms and block off floors and all that. And I think Elizabeth was a kind of demon woman at that time. She stepped in. That's a tough call to make at that time. But that would all have been part of the whole development of the structure.
I wonder if we could turn now to the whole issue of secularization. I just wonder if you could offer your own personal perspective of those years, before 1970 and immediately after.
Well, it was a logical thing to have to develop. And again, I think they came again from the Jesuit philosophical approach to the thing. It was. I think everyone would like to see it go a little more slowly. Now, when I say that, you like to think, well, you might have lost something in moving from the small, you know. I don't know what it would be now. At the time, I was all for it. I was all for the admission of women. I thought this was terrible. You know? Mrs. Smith and myself were at a radio conversation one day, CBC at noon or something. And I kind of got wrapped up in a knuckle like that, not by the Jesuits who came by the Archdiocese of the Lord. And I made a statement about, you know, whatever their arguments were for, they certainly didn't exist anymore once we accepted a penny of government money. He had no right to refuse admission of women other than on the grounds of academic qualifications. And the secularization had come about pretty much in its own philosophically, but before it developed logically. Then when Vatican II came along, the Aggiornamento, and Jesuits started leaving, it just speeded up. When that began, there were, three of us laymen in the administration, maybe four. There was Jim Ryan, myself, Dave Basley, and Leo, and Lori Smith. There were four of us. And Bill Bridgio may have been there at that time, but he wasn't, it just commenced there. Next thing, the president is gone, so we have to get a president. So Edmund comes in, as interim president. Edmund very much developed his own job description. He was assistant to Father